From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The American Academy of Pediatrics is now recommending that all students over the age of 2 wear masks in school, regardless of vaccination status. And the Academy says all staff should also wear masks as well, because many children aren't eligible for vaccines. Dr. Kristen Moffitt is a pediatrician and infectious disease specialist at Boston Children's Hospital. Doctor, the kids over 2 going to school, that's preschool. But as you know, earlier this month, the CDC said vaccinated children don't have to wear masks in schools. Now the Academy of Pediatrics is saying they do. Who's right, in your opinion?
So I tend to think of these guidelines that have been set forth first in terms of their similarities. And what they have in common is that both are prioritizing having children of all ages return to full in-person school in the fall. So they both start there. And then where they differ, the CDC guidance calling for the possibility of vaccinated students and staff not masking in schools really left open the option for modifying that recommendation depending on local transmission rates and COVID-19 vaccine coverage rates amongst eligible populations in certain geographies. And these are two measurements whose trajectories we know are very closely linked. So where they differ next is that the AAP really just takes that additional step of recommending that added layer of precautions, masking for everyone in our schools, regardless of vaccination status, to offset the variability in those factors that we see nationwide.
Okay, so places in like Mississippi, Arkansas, where they're seeing a surge in infections, they could decide, you know what, the CDC said masks just for unvaccinated, we're going to also require for vaccinated. In other words, you can always adjust that recommendation.
That's right. And the CDC guidelines really leave it open for places locally to look at what's going on in their region. And I don't think that the AAP guidance is wrong at all. The AAP guidance is really taking what we learned from in-person school settings last year, which was that universal masking in schools was a very critical component of the layered measures that kept transmission in our schools at a minimum, and that's when no one was vaccinated. So they are adding back that layer of precaution, considering the huge variability in transmission rates and vaccine coverage that we're seeing across our nation.
Yeah, and we want to talk about transmission in a second, but when it comes to vaccines, where are we on kids? Because right now, children over the age of 12 are eligible. Clinical trials are underway for younger kids. Tell us more.
So both Moderna and Pfizer began clinical trials in those under the age of 12 last March or April. And the Pfizer studies are what we've heard a bit more about recently. They have a couple of cohorts in their trials. They have 5 to 11-year-olds, 2 to 5-year-olds, and then the really young, the 6-month to 2-year-olds. What we've heard from Pfizer is that we might expect results in the 5 to 11-year-old cohort by September, maybe October of this year. And if that all looks safe and effective in terms of immune responses, they'd file for emergency use authorization. I think realistically, given the safety parameters that the FDA is going to be looking so closely at, realistically, vaccines would not likely be available for those 5 to 11, more likely late fall, maybe early winter of this year, and then probably even more like winter 2022 for those 5 and under.
Well, and could you help parents with this? Because as you just mentioned, these are still under review by the FDA, which is being very cautious. But that doesn't mean they're experimental. They're not experimental at all. They are under review, which is it's a huge difference. But speak to parents worried about this. Obviously, people consult with their own doctors. But what is your sense of once these are cleared? They're already cleared for children over 12, possibly soon going to be cleared for younger kids. Speak to a parent about how they should consider vaccinations.
So I think what parents need to understand is that not only are these vaccines not experimental, but these vaccines are being required to meet the same safety standards that every vaccine, every medication that's gone forward for licensure from the FDA has ever had to meet. The FDA is requesting 4 to 6 months of safety data for follow-up in the vaccine trials that are occurring in those under the age of 12. And I think the other thing parents should understand is that safety data continue to accumulate even after these vaccines are authorized. And that's much of what we've been experiencing as we have been hearing about some of the rare side effects that are being recognized in people of different ages once you begin vaccinating millions and millions of people.
What about vaccinated parents worried about infecting their unvaccinated kids? Should the parents still wear masks?
So I think parents need to be thinking about what kinds of exposures they may still be having if they live in a part of the country where transmission is on the rise rapidly, where hospitalizations are on the rise, and where vaccine coverage is very low. Parents should still strongly consider masking when they're going to be indoors, particularly indoors with large numbers of people.
Dr. Kristen Moffitt, pediatrician and infectious disease specialist at Boston Children's Hospital, thank you.
Sure, thanks for having me.
A major opioid settlement appears close to finalization. It's worth $26 billion, and it would resolve a pile of lawsuits against pharmaceutical companies, including Johnson & Johnson, Cardinal Health, and others. State and local governments sued these companies for their alleged roles in fueling the opioid crisis. Hundreds of thousands of Americans have died since 1999. And this news comes as the Department of Justice is condemning a separate proposed bankruptcy settlement involving Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin. Let's untangle these threads with NPR addiction correspondent Brian Mann. Brian, let's start with the settlement involving Johnson & Johnson, McKesson, Cardinal Health, and AmerisourceBergen. These are companies that make and distribute opioids. $26 billion would go to state and local governments. That's the top line. What else do we know about this deal?
Yeah, Callum, it's a super complicated deal, and it's not completely finalized yet. There was a press conference earlier today with Joe Rice, with the firm Motley Rice. He's one of the lead litigators suing Big Pharma over opioids, and he said there are a few details yet to be worked out. He sounded like he thinks this is very close to the finish line, but as this negotiation goes forward, what this is going to mean is that over time, about 17 years, billions of dollars will flow to communities all across the country. Remember, these are firms that distributed tens of millions of prescription painkillers, often to places that were hit very hard by the opioid epidemic. And so that's the hope, is that once this gets out there, states will approve this deal. Local communities will approve the deal. There are a lot of legal steps still to be followed here, but eventually that money could get to places where people are still hurting.
I see. And then how would the money be used, Brian? Because we know that some big tobacco settlement money was sort of in the general fund in some cases. Is this going to be more precise? And what else might be included in the settlement?
Yeah, so this is interesting. There's a lot of reaction here to the tobacco settlement, where, as you say, a lot of the money that came from that deal in the 1990s was siphoned away just into the general fund. Here, state and local officials say the lion's share, about $23 billion of this, is earmarked for things like therapy and treatment and the social programs that are desperately needed in these places where addiction rates and overdose death rates remain really, really high. And so that's going to be an interesting part of this, to see if it can start to bend those devastating curves downward. We saw another record level of overdose deaths, 93,000 again last year. And so this is the question. Can these resources really start to push this epidemic back?
Okay, so that's one major development. And then we have this other proposed settlement in bankruptcy court, Brian, that involves Purdue Pharma and members of the Sackler family, who were among the company's owners. Now, the Justice Department said yesterday that this plan is unconstitutional and illegal. Why such a strong reaction?
Well, there's this really interesting provision of this bankruptcy, and interesting means controversial in this case. What it does is it gives members of the Sackler family who own this company and a long list of their associates immunity from opioid lawsuits, even though they haven't filed for bankruptcy and even though many of the people on this list aren't actually contributing cash to the settlement. And so what the DOJ came forward and said in very strong language yesterday was that this is an overreach by the bankruptcy court, that it denies people due process to bring their claims against all of these individuals who may allegedly have had some role in the opioid epidemic. So this was really startlingly strong language from the Justice Department.
And what's Purdue Pharma saying?
They're saying that they believe that this deal has precedent, that there have been other complicated bankruptcy cases where individuals have been released from liability, even though they themselves aren't bankrupt. And they also say that the billions of dollars that will be contributed by the Sacklers and by Purdue Pharma will help people. It'll go just like that other big national settlement we were talking about. It'll go to help communities respond and recover to these high rates of death. And so they think it should go forward.
Well, this is such a huge piece of the context, right, Brian, is that the overdoses continue to be a scourge. And so there's this real urgency, I think, among states to get some money to people who need it. And the number of states supporting this Purdue Pharma deal is growing. So in the moment we have left, what are the prospects now? Does the DOJ complaint put the brakes on it, or is it going to go forward, do you think?
Everyone I talked to, Colin, said they think this will be finalized. There's a hearing, a confirmation hearing, August 9th. And the judge in this case, Robert Drain, is expected to move it forward. He'll have to address the DOJ's concerns. But this looks like a deal where the Sacklers will walk away, admitting no wrongdoing and remaining one of the wealthiest families in the U.S.
That's NPR addiction correspondent Brian Mann. Brian, thanks.
Thank you.
In Northern California, there's a movement to educate people about climate change and rising sea levels, and organizers want to hear from residents as they develop their climate strategies. As Ezra David Romero of member station KQED reports, their primary tool has been listening.
Ever Rodriguez and I are driving in his white pickup and just crossed the border from Menlo Park into the community of North Fair Oaks in San Mateo County.
On the other side of Menlo Park, more affluent area, you saw a lot of beautiful oaks. But here on this side, there aren't any trees, really. Just all asphalt.
The unincorporated city of roughly 15,000 is smaller than 2 square miles. Rodriguez moved here from Mexico City 25 years ago and serves on the volunteer North Fair Oaks Community Council. The main drag in this predominantly Latino area is lined with taquerias, popsicle shops, and jewelry stores.
It so happens that I find the food that I eat here, I find the culture that I've been interacting with here, you know, I feel more at home.
In 2018, San Mateo County awarded the community a grant to deal with sea level rise. But community advocates and Stanford students were surprised with what residents like Linda Lopez told them.
I just wasn't thinking about it because we've never had any degree of flooding. We think we live far enough from the bay that if it did rise, it's not going to affect us.
Lopez moved to North Fair Oaks in 1959 when she was 9. She says there are many elderly people here with respiratory problems.
The two main environmental issues in this area is the heat and smoke.
This is where that fundamental part of conversation comes in. The organizers going door to door realized they had to listen. Ever Rodriguez says instead of just continuing with a sea level rise project, the team pivoted.
We started planting trees in the community.
Partnering with a nonprofit called Canopy that plants free trees in people's yards.
I think all public servants need to be guided by listening.
But what does listening actually do? Britt Ray studies the mental health impacts of climate change at Stanford and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. She says listening replaces the mindset that the government or scientists know what's best for communities.
Domination is the predominant force in this crisis as compared with true partnership that centers around human values like reciprocity and trust and dignity and respect.
Ray says listening empowers people to come up with climate solutions that better life on Earth.
We can actually start moving towards the world that isn't the one we've been living in, but the one that we want to live in. And we can't do that without listening deeply to the people who are most affected.
The kind of thing I'm especially learning by listening is the blind spots that you have in your conception of what problems there are.
Derek Oyang is the North Fair Oaks project partner with Stanford. One of those blind spots was a tree equals maintenance costs.
It sort of became clear that if that's going to be a barrier no matter what, that there's going to be a monetary challenge, then let's tackle that head on.
They found a county grant program, and now residents get $100 gift cards to garden stores when they agree to a tree. Still, some renters and landlords say no.
And that is maybe harder for someone like me to understand. If I were able to get a tree, I think I would just, without question, happily take it. But that's a kind of broadening of our understanding of the different factors that affect people's lives.
Ouyang is working with Violet Wufsa-Ena with a nonprofit, Climate Resilient Communities. This idea of listening is Wufsa-Ena's. When she was Samoa's first climate change officer, she met with village leaders whose ancestral burial grounds were threatened by flooding.
It's really about being in their shoes, the conflicts, the barriers that they're facing.
Wufsa-Ena and Ouyang are expanding this concept of listening in neighboring communities. Their goal is to recruit and listen to 500 families over 5 years.
What do you think you'll have learned about these communities by listening to them?
It's likely the case that we'll find that the social and psychological effects of climate exposure are going to be so much deeper than we like to admit right now. And that will look like trauma, that will look like increasingly foregoing healthy food and the kinds of care you want to provide for your children.
Ouyang thinks they'll learn how vulnerable these communities are. The hope is that listening to community members will lead to solutions that help them thrive amidst the ongoing climate crisis. For Here and Now, I'm Ezra David Romero.
Are you planning to visit a national park this summer? They're popular destinations because many folks are itching to get outdoors after more than a year of being cooped up amid the pandemic. But if you enter with unrealistic expectations, you could wind up disappointed. So to help visitors get the most out of their experience, we're bringing in artist and national park enthusiast Amber Scher. She knows all about the risk of disappointment because she collects one-star reviews of national parks on Yelp and other websites and shares them on Instagram. She's paired some of the crankiest with her own beautiful illustrations of the parks and compiled them in a new book called Subpar Parks, America's Most Extraordinary National Parks and Their Least Impressed Visitors. Amber, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
The complaints that folks have about national parks, if they show up and turn out to be disappointed, kind of fall into like several common buckets, which you outline at the start of your book. Could you run through a few of those for us? What is it that people are griping about when they go to these majestic venues?
Yeah, so the reviews that I focus on all kind of have to do with the scenery and the experience in nature. So within that, you'll find a lot of people who complain about the exact feature the park is known for, which I kind of call that's a feature, not a bug. Those kind of reviews are people upset that Joshua Tree is a desert, or that they saw only one humpback whale at Kenai Fjords, which many people who visited have told me they'd be over the moon to have even gotten to see.
I like the complaint about the tall grass at Tall Grass Prairie in Kansas. What did you think?
Yes, exactly. I'm not sure what else you were expecting, but that is what it's intended to be. And then somewhat related to that, which is another one of my favorite kind of categories that emerged, is people who say something that is technically true, but is also kind of the most reductive way you could ever sum up that park. So, for example, calling the Grand Canyon just a very large hole would fall into that category. That, to me, takes a special level of unimpressed to just see something so grand and so huge and just reduce it to the absolute minimal description you could find.
Must have been a real head-scratcher for you because you write that the Grand Canyon was really the birth of your fascination with national parks back when you were just 10 years old. You've been collecting these complaints about parks for a while, and this is actually not entirely new phenomenon. These bad national park reviews have sort of captured the fascination of folks for several years, but your Instagram account collecting them has really taken off. Why do you think that is?
I think it's pretty hard to separate the project from the pandemic at this point, just because I started it just a few months before that all began. And so I think a lot of us were kind of trapped in our houses, unable to have the trips that we were dreaming of having. And so being able to kind of laugh at the people who hated exactly what you wish you were getting to do right now was a little bit of a salve for that sadness. But also, I think just all of us have that curmudgeon in us that wants to complain about things. So it gives you a kind of way to even laugh at yourself a little bit. Because I've even noticed since I started the project times where I just really want to complain about something. And then I just laugh at myself for how ridiculous it is.
Well, let's talk then about how we can get over that maybe impulse to complain and really get the most out of the experience, particularly because there may be folks who wouldn't normally go to a national park, but that's what they're doing this summer because maybe they're not ready to hop on a plane and go to some far-flung place yet. And I'm thinking of actually that very first trip to the Grand Canyon that you write about, where you and your family spent several days there. And that seems to me an important detail. It's sort of like I'm a sports fan, so if I went to a baseball game to see my favorite slugger hit a home run. Well, even the best baseball players don't hit a home run every game. They might go a few games without hitting a home run. And so if I go in with unrealistic expectations, I'm going to be disappointed. Is that one of the keys? Maybe I would have to go to several baseball games to see what I want. Maybe somebody should spend more than a few hours at a national park.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the bigger issues at play here. I actually spoke with a ranger. She answered some questions for me who had worked at Everglades. And she spoke so beautifully about this park and said that it's a park that kind of whispers at you. It doesn't yell the way that some of the grander parks, you know, are more obvious about why they're a park. And so it's a place that you really need to be willing to sit and spend some time and really let it seep in. And I think that's true for a lot of parks. I think people might think they're going to just drive into Yellowstone and immediately check off seeing a grizzly in the distance and some bison and all of the sort of iconic things that people have come to know Yellowstone for. But really, to experience those kinds of things and to really understand what a place like Yellowstone is requires more than just a few hours driving through it.
And if you do happen upon a grizzly, by the way, you may not be able to post it on social media right away because, hey, you know, the cell signal or the Wi-Fi service may not be so great. That's another thing that you're cautioning people against, is thinking that you're going to be instantly connected. And there's actually value in unplugging when you go. Do you have a new favorite, Amber, after this project, or does it all come back to the original Grand Canyon for you?
The Grand Canyon will definitely still always have a place in my heart, but after this project, I think I am converted on going to Alaska, which I always thought was not for me because I'm not at all a cold weather person. But now that I've done this project, I absolutely have to go.
That's artist and illustrator Amber Scher. She is a national park enthusiast, and her new book is called Subpar Parks, America's Most Extraordinary National Park and Their Least Impressed Visitors. Amber, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And to see some of Amber's illustrations, go to hereandnow.org.
There is no denying that there is a lot going on in the economy right now.
So far in 2021, about 3,600 retail stores have closed.
You know, China has banned Bitcoin many times before, but this time it's looking pretty serious.
Understanding this stuff, it is kind of our thing here at The Indicator. It's how we like to spend our free time. Every day we explain something that is going on in the economy. Listen and follow The Indicator from Planet Money on NPR.
Democratic Senate Majority Leader Charles Schumer says there will be a vote tomorrow on whether to proceed with debate over the bipartisan infrastructure legislation. That plan hit a new snag Sunday when a lead negotiator, the Republican Senator Rob Portman, took an idea off the table that would have helped pay for it, increasing IRS tax collection. He acknowledged Republicans balked at helping the IRS go after more unpaid taxes. CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger, host of Jill on Money, is here. Jill, what would have been in this plan? Because collecting taxes, isn't that what the IRS is supposed to do?
Well, the deal would have provided a $40 billion budget increase for the IRS. And why is this important? Because that funding was essential because it would allow the IRS to collect taxes that are their due. You know, it's like saying, I billed the person for the work and the person won't pay me.
Well, explain that part of it, because this is a lot of tax money that's being hidden. I can hear a listener saying, wait a second, I got, you know, reviewed, I got audited for my little tiny, you know, tax payment. This would have been going after big bucks.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, this was basically going after essentially about $700 billion over the next 10 years, according to the White House. But let's just talk about like this gap that there is. They call it the official tax gap. And the IRS reported, and this is the most recent information we have, from 2011 to 2013, that gap, meaning here's your tax that's due, taxpayers. What they didn't collect was $441 billion. That is massive. So again, if you kind of wind the clock forward, what the government has done and what a lot of the folks in D.C. have done is they said, well, if we could just capture that money, then we don't have to raise taxes on people and people don't want to pay more taxes. There is a paper that was published by the Washington Center for Equitable Growth in March, and it showed that the bottom 50% of earners underreport about 7% of their income. The top 1% underreport 21%. So that means if we just go after the wealthiest, we might collect a lot of that unclaimed money.
Well, and Senator Portman and others, you know, acknowledge that part of the Republican pushback is that this would have gone after that money, money from corporations, from wealthy families. And it's interesting because, as you say, you'd think that Republicans in particular would be in favor of a more enhanced IRS because then they wouldn't have to raise taxes. But we're getting the whiff that this would have gone after wealthy people who might have been donors.
You know, a lot of the top earners are using perfectly legal mechanisms to minimize their taxes. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about taxes that are owed. When you slash the budget of your tax collecting agency, and the total budget at the IRS is down by about 50% since 1993, you can't do your job without enough money to go out and collect the money that's due. And I think that this would have been a very smart idea simply from the premise of fairness. That's all this is. It's not rich versus poor. It's not big versus little. It's fairness.
Well, we'll continue to follow this story. You know, the Biden administration has promised to increase funding. We'll see where that goes. And now how does the infrastructure bill get at least partially funded? We'll follow that as well. Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, host of Jill on Money. Thanks as always.
It's great to be with you.
Are you looking for a summer read that immerses you in the beauty of the natural world? Well, maybe recommend Helen MacDonald's essay collection, Vesper Flights, just out in paperback. I look at a field, I see and I love that field. Helen sees below the field, the nesting and burrowing inhabitants. You might have read her essays in the New York Times or her beautiful 2014 memoir, H is for Hawk, about how she dealt with grief over the death of her father by training a goshawk. It turns out, though, while I see her completely connected to the natural world, Helen MacDonald still sees a divide, and it's an appropriate one. And she sees those fields and meadows where none of us would, say, at the top of the Empire State Building. Again, Helen MacDonald's book is Vesper Flights. We spoke when it was first published. Welcome back.
It's so great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
This book is lovely. It's filled with short essays, but together they form a memoir. And it turns out the thing that I admired in you, this like intense connection with the natural world, we find out was a problem when you were a child. You'd wander away from like a team sport when you were a kid to hear a bird call, and that upset kids, and you were bullied.
Yeah, I was bullied. I was a strange child, you know. I don't think I fitted in at all. I was a very serious child, and I loved animals. And yeah, I was on a school sports day court, and I wandered off because I heard this bird song, and everyone was like, you know, what are you doing? You were in goal. So I think I just didn't really understand people back then. And you know, one of the great things that's happened, you know, growing up was I've learned to love people as well as animals. So I feel that's a triumph.
You also say in your very last essay that while you love those animals so much, you've come to realize they don't exist for us.
Yeah, I think it's one of the big, I guess, themes of this book. You know, we're living in a world, as all your listeners know, in which empathy seems to be in shorter and shorter supply. And when we look at animals, what we're seeing when we see them is it's very hard to see the real creature. What we're seeing is all the meaning we put on them, all the thing we've learned from from books and magazine articles and things we've heard about them and photographs. And I think it's important to think about what we bring to that moment of contact with a creature. If you're very lucky, you can think about what you've brought to that encounter, but then you can look past it and you can see the real animal, this strange non-human alien creature that possesses the world just as we possess the world. And you know, it's a real lesson about the fact that the world doesn't belong to us. It's a kind of radical empathy, and I think it's really important now.
They don't exist to teach us, even if they do. They have their own thing
exactly
going on. You mentioned growing up, and your childhood home was in a home that your parents bought on this 50-acre estate that was owned by the Theosophical Society. Your parents weren't theosophists, but your neighbors were. These are refugees from Nazi Germany. How did that impact you?
It was a grand crowd of mostly older ladies, and they were very eccentric. And they just lived their lives according to their own, you know, what they thought was right. They were not sticklers to convention at all. And they were a real inspiration to me, I think. You know, I was a strange child. I'm possibly a strange person. But I've never felt I needed to fit in with the stories that society tells you about what you're supposed to do. And I think those ladies, I bless them for that. And they had wonderful names. There was sort of Kate Batty Smith, who had a great orc egg in a drawer. And another person had a whole bunch of jewelry that Howard Carter had given her from his excavations in Egypt. I mean, they were really a grand old crew.
Well, this is interesting. Yes, it does sound like you fit right in. But you start the book in the introduction by describing a Wunderkammer. A cabinet of wonders?
Yes.
And I'm imagining that's something you learned there. And these are cabinets people would put things into touch and, you know, kind of marvel over them, preserve specimens, feathers. By the way, the book has been described as a Wunderkammer, too, you know, a collection of just wonders.
Yeah. It's a metaphor I came up with because, you know, I think we see the natural world so often these days as something that's behind, almost like it's behind plate glass. We're not supposed to touch it or interact with it. And it reminds me of how we walk around museums. All the exhibits are in cases and, you know, they're all kind of arranged according to particular categories and we stare at them seriously and we, you know, we muse on their meaning. But these Wunderkammer, these 16th century cases of curiosities, the whole point of them was that you could reach out and pick things up and examine them and glory in their weight and the differences from each other. And they weren't arranged like museum specimens. There were all sorts of things all pushed together, like shells and cloaks and weapons and paintings. And I wanted my book to be a little bit like that, to have all these different things that were wondrous, hopefully, all pushed into the same place and readers felt that they could kind of reach in and kind of be part of that story.
Talk about the Empire State Building. You hooked up with someone from the Cornell Ornithology Lab, who also is a part of a movement to document bird migration through radar and all these modern technologies. Twice a year, if you climb to the top of the Empire State Building, which shoots a light up, which is how you see these birds, and you bring your binoculars, what did you see?
It was the most sublime experience. It shook me, and it completely changed the way I think not only about New York City, a place that I really love, but also about the air. You know, I assumed that the air was this place that was pretty much empty, and, you know, it was dynamic, but there was nothing there. I climbed up the Empire State Building and met Andrew Farnsworth, and it was a big migration night. All these tiny birds were being pulled north by their instinct, you know, in May. And there were hundreds of thousands of birds going across New York. And they were so high that you can't see them from the ground. But, you know, we're high up enough to see them. And I was watching them through binoculars and, you know, through, with the naked eye as well. And these tiny little frames, these tiny songbirds that were illuminated from beneath by the lights of the building. And there were so many of them, they looked almost like tracer fire or sort of stars passing overhead. Mm. And they're so frail. And it was really emotional to sort of think of how that building operated a little bit like a deep sea submersible, only rather than taking me down to the depths of the ocean to see the creatures there, it was lifting me up into the sky. It was marvelous.
But you remind us, too, how dangerous the city can be for birds as they hit windows and buildings. And Andrew Farnsworth is part of a group. I remember when this happened, there's the tribute to the lives lost on September 11th. Lights are shot 4 miles into the air. And on peak migration nights, the songbirds are brought down to the lights. And so they flick around in them. You write like glittering, whirling specks of paper. And he, along with members of the Audubon Society, get them to turn the lights off several times so that they won't pull the birds in.
Yeah, it's a really poignant thought, these tiny souls being brought in and trapped in these columns that are there to commemorate, you know, the terrible loss of life on that day. And so he steps in and he turns them off every so often so the birds are freed from these columns of light and they can continue their journey. It's you know, really a strong kind of image to conjure with.
You describe seeing night herons flying over you when you're up on the Empire State Building. I will never look at the night sky the same way again after reading that. But staying with birds, swifts are especially compelling to you. You say they're the closest things to aliens on Earth. Why?
Well, they're a bit like angels too. I'm all over swifts. They're just magical. So they're incredibly aerial birds. They very rarely land. European swifts, once the youngsters leave the nest, they don't touch down at all for maybe 2 or 3 years. They live in the air as a fish would live in the ocean. And because they're so inaccessible to, you know, you can't really see them up close, I was always astounded by them. And I have an essay about this phenomenon called a Vespa flight. And it's something that science has discovered quite recently. And one of the things I try and do in this book, you know, we so often think that science subtracts beauty from the world, but actually, I think it just shows us more and more how astonishing everything is. So what these swifts do, they've discovered, is every morning and every evening, the birds will climb up higher and higher into the sky, and they'll reach these impossible heights, thousands and thousands of feet up. And they reach the apex of these flights at nautical twilight. And it turns out that one of the reasons they might be doing this is to find out exactly where they are. So they use the stars, they use polarization patterns in the sky. They can look out across the horizon and they can see oncoming weather systems and they can feel the wind from those clouds coming towards them. And then they decide what they're going to do next, where they're going to go. And they do that communally. And this image of swifts communally deciding where they are and what they're going to do next is a really important theme for me, in the sense that it seems that they're a kind of fable of community now. We are all, you know, with the pandemic, with what's happening, it's a year where we haven't been looking out to see our futures. And I don't know, the swifts just seem like a really important symbol for me about how we can do that better.
And Vesper Flights is the title of the essay Helen McDonald's written on swifts. It's also the title of her new collection of essays, Vesper Flights, You Will Take Wing. Helen, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Our conversation from last September, Vesper Flights, is out in paperback.
Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene's Twitter account is back up after a brief suspension last night for sharing misleading information about COVID-19. The Georgia Republican had posted that the disease was not dangerous for people unless they're obese or old, which is false, and said vaccines should not be required. It's not the first time Taylor Greene has been kicked off the platform, but it comes as the White House is calling out social media giants for facilitating the spread of conspiracy theories about coronavirus vaccines. President Biden said last week that bad info on Facebook is, quote, killing people. Kat Zakreski is technology reporter for The Washington Post and joins us now for more. Hey, Kat.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on the show.
Glad to have you. And the president did kind of walk back that comment about Facebook killing people with misinformation yesterday. He said that he had read an article about how the majority of misinformation on Facebook came from just 12 accounts. Here he is.
Facebook isn't killing people. These 12 people are out there giving misinformation. Anyone listening to it is getting hurt by it. It's killing people. It's bad information. My hope is Facebook, instead of taking it personally that somehow I'm saying Facebook is killing people, that they would do something about the misinformation, the outrageous misinformation about the vaccine.
So, Kat, what precisely is the president talking about? What does he want Facebook and other platforms to do to suppress misinformation that they're not doing already?
So the president is talking about this report on the so-called Disinformation Dozen, which came out earlier this year from the Center for Countering Digital Hate. And this report looked at some of the top people across social media who have repeatedly spread information that casts doubt on vaccines or promotes, you know, unsubstantiated cures for coronavirus. And these people, even with this research out there, have continued to maintain a strong presence on social media. You know, as we saw in the example of Twitter that you referenced, a lot of times the companies will take, you know, action against an individual post or temporarily suspend an account. But what we're seeing is often the same political figures, the same people who are part of, you know, the alternative health movement or so-called wellness movement online, coming back again and again and spreading this misinformation. So the White House last week put out a major advisory, and one of the things they called on the platforms to do was to take greater action against repeat offenders. They also want to see the platforms do a better job of elevating verified information from authoritative sources like the CDC and other health officials.
I see. And as we're talking about Facebook, I should point out that the company is a financial supporter of NPR. Kat, what is Facebook saying in response to the White House?
So Facebook is trying to make the case that they have been investing in this work. Since the early days of the pandemic, Facebook has recognized that this would be a major issue. It started, you know, initially around information about false cures for coronavirus spreading on Facebook. And as the pandemic has evolved and vaccines have come out, the bigger concern has been, you know, misinformation that could deter people from going out and actually getting their shot. And so throughout this time, the company has been making investments in taking content down. You know, according to the company, they've taken down more than 18 million pieces of misinformation about the coronavirus. But what we're seeing is that's not everything. And really, Facebook has made it difficult for researchers, for journalists, even the White House, to understand the scope of the problem because, you know, so much of this is happening in closed aspects of the platform, private groups messaging one-on-one on Facebook. And so it's really hard right now for outsiders to really get a handle on what's actually happening on the platform when it comes to vaccine misinformation and how bad this is. You know, Facebook says, you know, we're focused on this and we're taking a lot of steps on this effort, but it's part of a broader pattern where we've seen misinformation about the election process, about the 2016 elections, et cetera, spread on Facebook. And so there's a lot of skepticism when the company says, hey, this is something we're working on.
Yeah, it's a good point that you bring up the disclosures because, you know, the 18 million pieces of misinformation is one data point. A more telling data point might be the number of people who were exposed to that misleading information. And Facebook is not disclosing that figure. Do they just not know or do they know and they're not telling us?
So there's some new reporting in the New York Times out last night that Facebook itself, you know, didn't make investments when its own employees asked for resources to do work measuring the spread of misinformation on the platform. They asked for the company to make some key hires to help with that, and the company just didn't do it. So, you know, obviously we know that Facebook has access to vast amount of data. This is something that they certainly could look into if they wanted to. It's just unclear right now if this is something that they've dedicated people, time, and resources to. And you know, a lot of the company's critics are saying if they haven't dedicated people to measuring this problem, that really shows, you know, an abdication of responsibility when the company has been, you know, publicly saying all along that it would take medical misinformation seriously and be more aggressive in combating it than it has been in some other types of harmful content that we continually see circulating on the service.
Sure. Kat Zakreski is a technology and policy reporter for The Washington Post. Kat, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Callum Borchers.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.